Kuban, southern Russia, is blessed with copious amounts of rich soil and glorious sunshine, making it the perfect region to find flavours that rival those in Tuscany or Provence. So get ready to tantalise your taste buds and let's sample some of the fruits of the land. Kuban is full of lush fields, full of sunflowers stretching off into the horizon. But we're not just here to admire their majestic beauty. There's a real science to growing sunflowers. So let's meet a man who's worked with them for well over 30 years.
Alexander, I've always been fascinated by sunflowers and I've wondered how they open up and then track the sun during the day like mini solar panels. How do they do it?
Primarily with the help of hormones. They're called phytohormones. There are fewer phytohormones on the shaded side and more produced where the sun hits. These hormones are what make sunflowers turn and face the sun. They're called sunflowers after all. In the morning, they face east or northeast. They point upwards around noon and turn their heads west by sunset. This rotation depends on the age of the flower. It's more pronounced in younger plants. By the time the seeds are ripening, the process stops. From then on, it stops turning towards the sun.
Because it doesn't need to anymore.
Now it constantly points east. The phytohormones die and the plant begins to dry out as it completes its life cycle before harvesting.
And I guess the stem has to be pretty robust to hold the flower and the seeds and all. How is it unique? How is it different from other flowers?
The sunflower has an erect and sturdy stem. These lignified nodes at the bottom of the receptacle help attach the flower head securely to the stem as the plant grows and develops. The receptacle may tilt somewhat during ripening, but it's still firmly attached.
The seeds form these really satisfying concentric circles or spirals. Why is that?
This is mostly genetics, the biology of the receptacle. The sunflower is an excellent entomophilic plant, which means it relies on bees for pollination. The spiral placement of the seeds resembles a honeycomb, so I think it makes the flower more attractive to bees. Apart from the pheromones, the smell, nectar, and this beautiful layout, attract bees to visit.
And how many seeds can a sunflower hold?
Various sources give you different figures ranging from 500 or 750 to 2,000. But let me stress this once again. Much depends on the environment.
Alexander, you've worked here for an amazing 36 years. You must have a favourite sunflower type.
My favourite variety is Cruiz. My second favourite variety is Umnik. It's a versatile variety that we've been planting extensively for a couple of decades. It provides high oil yields and has some unique oil properties.
Now, not all sunflowers are the same. There are dozens of breeds, each adapted to different conditions and suited to different food products. And this lab creates new varieties for an ever-changing world.
I see you have a couple of samples here, including one that looks a bit like butter. Can you tell me about those, please?
This is sunflower oil. There are some of our newest developments we've been working on lately. Our institute is committed to improving the properties of our oil. There are three samples here. One is classical sunflower oil, which we all use. The second one is high oleic sunflower oil, which means it has a high concentration of oleic acid, about 90%. It gives it a longer shelf life and much greater oxidative stability. Sample number three is solid sunflower oil, which we've created only recently. It has a high concentration of both oleic oleic and stearic acids. Stearic acid is a saturated fatty acid. When oil contains a lot of saturated fatty acids, it's a solid, like palm or coconut oil. That's what makes these oils solid. I'm sure everyone has heard at least something about saturated fats being bad for you, but they're not all equally unhealthy. There are some saturated fatty acids which are really unhealthy, and there are more neutral ones. Stearic acid is considered to be nutritionally neutral, so a higher stearic acid content isn't a negative. Consuming it can actually be healthy for you.
So how long does it take you to develop a new variety of sunflower from concept to the field?
It depends on the parameter we intend to modify. The selection is an ongoing process, and we constantly work on improving the characteristics or introducing new ones. High stearic sunflower oil, for example, took us 6 years from the initial concept to the official registration of this hybrid and obtaining permission to cultivate it.
Okay, so not quick.
It's not so long, actually. It used to take more time. But we're working to cut the R&D time by using hothouse and hydroponics and water. It allows us to obtain several generations of plant per year and speed things up.
And if you had to develop the ideal variety of sunflower, what would it be?
An ideal variety should be resistant to main pathogens. It should also be stable in different environmental conditions. Russia is huge, so we need to develop hybrids that will be planted in very diverse locations. We must make sure that this variety will perform well not only here, but in other places as well, cooler places, drier or rainier climates, etc. And of course, an ideal variety should be able to adapt to environmental changes.
Of course. From field to factory, making and bottling sunflower oil is an art and a science. We head to a plant to see the hypnotic process for ourselves. How long does it take for a sunflower seed to make it from the field and into a bottle here?
It's 3 days on average. Day one, harvesting in the field. Day two, pressing oil from the plant seeds. During day three, we refine and bottle the oil. This is the average timeline, depending on the volume. Oil production is a continuous process, but 3 days should be enough.
So it's quite quick then.
Sunflower oil can oxidize. Ideally, it should be processed and bottled as soon after pressing as possible. This way, it can retain all its wholesome properties and have a longer shelf life.
And what's the importance of cold pressing oil?
Cold pressing allows the oil to retain all its wholesome components, which would be removed by further processing.
Well, I think that's enough talking for now. Can I taste some of your oil, please?
Sure. We'll now proceed to the room where we bottle oil, and we'll taste it right off the production line.
Perfect. Constantine, how do you properly taste oil? Does it have flavor notes, a special aftertaste?
Let's just give it a try.
Okay, with pleasure. Cheers.
Let's taste it.
It's a bit salty.
We tasted it, but it's really up to our lab guys. They take a spoonful of oil, taste it, don't swallow it, but breathe it in, spit the oil out, and analyze the aftertaste, the flavor, etc. If everything is okay, the oil is fresh and high quality. Then it can be released onto the production line.
It's almost a bit like wine then.
It's not really the same as wine. When you appraise wine, you need to consider its taste, smell, and color. With oil, the purpose of refining is the opposite. We make sure it doesn't have any organoleptic properties.
So I take it you don't have a favorite harvest year then, and you can't tell when the oil was made by its taste.
That's right. Seeds do vary from harvest to harvest, but the result is always the same sunflower oil that doesn't have any personality. It's tasteless, odorless, and colorless. It doesn't contain any additional substances which are removed at the previous stage.
It's quite a simple question, but how does refined oil differ from non-refined?
Unrefined oil is obtained by mechanical seed pressing, followed only by mechanical purification. Unlike refined oil, which is also treated chemically and all accompanying substances are removed.
Well, extra virgin olive oil seems to be almost the gold standard of healthy oils. Do you think that modern sunflower oil can in any way even begin to compete with that?
Look, not really. However, there are some high oleic sunflower varieties which produce oil that's rich in acid, which is the valuable component of olive oil.
Constantine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Of course, we couldn't head to Kuban without sampling some of the other fruits of the land, grapes. The wine industry here is full-bodied, easy on the palate, and leaves a pleasant aftertaste.
Chateau Pinot is what's known as a gravity flow winery. What is that, Olga?
First off, our production process is made possible by this terrain. The 2-hectare lot in the Caucasus Piedmont allowed us to design a winery with 5 distinct levels. There are currently no more than 5 level gravity flow wineries around the world.
Amazing. And what's the advantage of this type of production?
The wine gets subjected to less stress. What's stress in winemaking? Grapes undergo many transformations before they become wine. The fruit gets crushed, which is followed by fermentation, filtering, transportation between different containers, chilling, etc. Each of these stages causes stress. The more stress the wine experiences, the lower its quality. A gravity flow winery has fewer stress points, which helps retain quality during the transition from fruit to wine.
Got you. Could someone with a more refined palate than mine even taste this gravity in the final product?
I'm sure you can. We'll now be able to see it.
I wasn't hinting at anything, by the way.
Oxygen is winemaker's arch enemy. Stress experienced at each stage results in the capture of more oxygen molecules, which affects quality.
Is that the oxidization?
Right. Oxidation at each stage. Our wines... We're a young winery, of course. Our products were first released in 2019, but our wines are full of life. They retain the color, the aroma, and the taste. A wine connoisseur would certainly recognize the gravity process in the glass due to all the berry notes in our reds, the smooth taste, and the right amount of tannins. These are all indications of the gravity flow process we use.
Well, I've not reached the level of being able to tell that a wine was made through the gravity flow method, but that was certainly very delicious. Thank you very much, Olga. Is it true that there's no such thing as bad soil when it comes to growing grapes, just the wrong type of grape for that soil? I mean, here you have mountains and sea nearby. How did you go about picking a grape?
In viticulture, they say you can start harvesting grapes after 4 years. But grape wines really need to be at least 10 years old before they mature enough to produce quality wine.
10 years, okay.
The older your wines, the better the quality of the fruit they bear. Because what happens is that the fruit gets smaller while the concentration of flavor and pigment gets higher, and the overall quality of your raw material improves. So the older, the better. But the crucial component is the people who work with these grapes. You can make some very poor wines using very old wines. It's not a given that wines made from older grape wines will always be better. However, if you have all the necessary components in place, you can produce a great wine. Only 2% of all wines in the world today can be considered great. And every winemaker dreams of creating a great wine someday. We're going to open a bottle of Petnat as we're watching this gorgeous sunset. It's the color of the setting sun.
Oof, I like that sound.
Now, I've heard this really weird phrase in Russian, that the first sniff of a wine is called the angel's kiss. Is that true? And if so, why?
If we look into history, and this can be seen in picture galleries, a grape wine has traditionally been compared to a person. A grape wine produces grapes, which are made into wine. Therefore, wine is born like a human being, so it is also compared to a person. It's always been said that aroma is the soul of wine. So it makes sense to say that the first sniff of a wine is an angel's kiss, because angels are always close to people. Maybe perched on their shoulders. So the first sniff, yeah.
Well, Olga, we stood long enough with these glasses of wine in our hands. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise with me today. Cheers. Nestled away in the vine-covered hills, Chateau Pinot lets gravity do the heavy lifting in its winemaking process and even boasts a snail farm. Alia, tell me, why did you decide to set up this snail farm at your winery?
It's a really long story, which started with wine, naturally. Wine always needs to be paired with food. It's about gastronomy. We thought, what would be the best way to showcase our wine to the world? Great pairings, of course, and we should produce them in-house. Raising cattle to make steaks for reds would take too long. Fish is something you can get at any restaurant. We needed something more interesting and inextricably connected to wine, so eventually we decided on a snail farm. But not immediately. Initially, when we were building this winery, we found Ammonites during the earthwork. There was an ancient ocean here where vineyards now grow. The tectonic plates later shifted, causing the bottom to rise, and today we are where we are. So we found those ancient ocean dwellers when we were excavating. They're not closely related to snails, of course, but they still have a shell and look very much like a snail. That's why we decided we simply had to build a snail farm.
And what makes the taste of a snail such a good accompaniment to a glass or a bottle of wine?
What's great about a snail is the neutral taste of its meat. Its flavor depends on the sauce. So if we add a white Provençal sauce, the snails will pair handsomely with whites, while snails with a red Burgundy sauce are an incredible pairing for reds.
Krynica isn't your average vineyard. Each batch is nurtured from vine to bottle. Even its magnificent cellar reflects the surrounding environment, the essence of which is captured in every drop.
Alexander, nice to meet you.
Oh,
hi.
Hello, Peter. Nice to meet you.
They say that geography is everything when it comes to winemaking. What does this location, with its hills, the sea just down there, what does it give the wine you produce here?
What does it give the wine? Well, we're on the 44th parallel. That's just one step south of Bordeaux. Bordeaux is the perfectly balanced location for great wines. You're right when you say that the place has a huge influence on winemaking. But I'd add this. It's the terroir that determines everything. And the winemaker's role is simply to reveal its potential. Here, we have a combination of warm climate and plenty of sun with the proximity of the Black Sea, which softens the heat and creates mild winters. There's also the Peshada River, which brings cool air and allows us to create fresh, balanced white wines. And of course, beyond terroir, what also influences the character of the wine is the variety of grape. By choosing the varieties, we shape the taste.
Alexander, I read somewhere that geneticists are trying to develop all sorts of grapes that have a natural resistance to pests and drought. Do you think that they'll be able to do this, but while preserving the flavour?
Yes, that's a big, almost philosophical question. When humans cultivate vineyards, we break three laws of nature. First, we propagate clones of the vine. That's the first, a somewhat unnatural step. Second, we plant monocultures. And third, we grow these monocultures over large areas. All this disrupts nature's balance. Still, we try to restore some balance by planting cover crops, hedgerows, things like that. There are research institutes that have been working for over 10 years to develop grape varieties that are more resistant to fungal diseases. The fungi live freely in the wild, while vines are no longer wild. They are centuries-old cultures that we keep to this day. The question is, are people willing to have the taste of their wine change because of these new varieties? I doubt it.
People also talk about grown wine and crafted wine. What's the difference?
Yes, the difference is significant. Of course, we have our own vineyards, and that's absolutely essential for creating great wines. Without great grapes, there is no great wine. If there is no one overseeing the entire process, from planting the vine to the wine glass, you won't get the desired result. To achieve this, you have an enologist. He's like the conductor of an orchestra. He sets the rhythm for the vineyard and gives notes to the wine, bringing the power of nature into the glass as he envisions it.
Alexander, I've heard that the cellar here is quite something. Would you mind showing me?
Yes, absolutely. Especially now, with the bottling underway, we have to hurry up.
Alexander, when I think of a wine cellar, it normally conjures up an image of a dark, damp place. But this, it's like a work of art. What was the thinking behind it?
You know, Gelendzhik is unique. In its landscape, its geology, its history, its civilization. The idea wasn't to create something absolutely new and different here. No, we wanted to have a sense of continuity, to connect with the culture that has always been here, with the traditions of winemaking that have long existed here. That's how we came up with these uneven arches, to make it feel like you're inside a cave. You can feel the moisture in the air, even on the floor. It's as if it holds some secrets, or maybe even a touch of magic. Everything here is designed to reflect the spirit of nature, of civilization, and maybe even of God. And everything that's connected to humanity.
It's certainly quite a space. And how do you tell when a wine is ready to be bottled, when it's reached its peak of taste?
The wine needs to spend several years in the bottle. In a way, it's like a grown man, still holding on to his youth, the freshness, the humor, but now also mature. So it has a calming effect. It can tell a long, extraordinary, even magical story. Time is paused inside the bottle, and the beauty of it is that one day that wine will give you more than just pleasure. It will fill you with emotion, and that's what makes it a real wine.
I've never heard wine described like that before, Alexander.
When you taste a young wine, can you already get a sense of what it's going to be like in, say, 5, 10, 15 years' time?
I can tell you that even when tasting a young wine, before it's even bottled, you can already understand its structure. It's like the foundation. For reds, it's the tannin structure. For whites, it might be a certain oily texture. That's the base of a wine. Then there is acidity, freshness. These are like the supporting walls that will hold up the whole building over time. If both are there, then you've got a chance that your wine will still be alive and expressive years later.
Okay, wow. Well, Alexander, thank you very much for sharing some of your expertise with us today. Cheers.
Thank you for being u nas w gościach.
My pleasure was all mine. Thank you.